you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to be with you today. My thanks to Austin Cross for hosting Monday and Tuesday. He'll be back with you tomorrow and Friday as usual, of course. This is my one day. I'll be with you this week as I've got a number of different events that are going on. Last night, I was at UC Santa Barbara for the Roop Great Debate, which I moderated on homelessness and housing challenges. Terrific audience there in Campbell Hall, and just a real pleasure to be on the UCSB campus last night for that event. Back home around midnight and with you this morning. So glad to join you on Air Talk. Coming up later on the program, we're going to be talking about the remarkable story of a World War I hero who ended up with a legacy far more mixed than you would have thought in the earlier years of his life. But we begin with California legislation that would mandate an approach to reading which is phonics-based. Joining us is the legislator who has written the bill that's been introduced, Blanca Rubio, Democratic State Assembly member who represents West Covina, Glendora, and surrounding communities. Thank you so much, Assembly Member Rubio, for joining us on Air Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course, we're all aware of the reading wars, as they've been dubbed, the debate over how best to teach reading to kids. Here we've got the science of reading that has been heavily researched that you would like to see universally used in California public schools. What's your reason for introducing this as a mandate?
Well, it's no surprise to anybody that California doesn't rank well in reading or student literacy. Currently, 4 in 10 California third grade students leave elementary school without proper literacy. And I spent 16 years in the classroom. I taught kindergarten, first grade, and fourth grade. And so I, not only as a legislator, am aware of what's happening, but when I was in the classroom, I saw it firsthand. So I am advocating and making sure that our kids get the proper education that they deserve. On top of, again, my personal experience, I am a second language learner. I was born in Mexico and didn't come to the United States until I was 6 the first time and 7 the following time. And so this, I believe, will help low-income students, second language learners, and quite frankly, all of our students in California.
And what currently is the mix of the way in which reading is instructed? I know we've gone back and forth between whole language. We've had Open Court was a very popular mm-hmm. curriculum that was used in many public schools like LA Unified. So what's the range now of what's offered?
So there is an adoption period. Every 10 years, California has to adopt a new curriculum, and there's usually 3 programs to choose from. I taught Open Court when I was a teacher, and it was a great program, but it's just a program. As fabulous as they can be, there is no real science base behind how to teach the program, not necessarily that the programs are bad. It's just the research that has been conducted indicates that we need to teach kids reading in a certain way. And so just the program to have a program doesn't necessarily work. It's the methods and the strategies that are implemented in the classroom that make the students actually be more literate.
We're talking with California Assembly Member, Democrat from West Covina and surrounding area, Blanca Rubio, who has introduced the bill which calls for the Science of Reading program to be used statewide in California. Also with us is Dean of USC's Rossier School of Education, Pedro Noguera. Dean Noguera, welcome back to Air Talk. What are your thoughts about Assembly Member Rubio's bill?
So thanks, Larry. Great to be with you. I certainly understand the assembly member's concern. There are far too many kids in schools not learning to read, and our proficiency rates show it. What I'm concerned about, though, is mandating to districts because, you know, I mean, although Assembly Member Blanco is a former educator herself, what we run the risk of is politicizing education. And I think what we want is to make education as non-political as possible. This really should be coming from the State Department of Education. They should be providing guidance to schools as well as professional development to teachers. Because we know that a foundation in literacy and in phonics is going to be helpful for developing literacy throughout a child's life. So I'm concerned about mandates. We don't use mandates with the local control funding formula. I actually think we need guidance there, guidelines, and I think the same is needed right now for reading.
Dean Nogueira, so are there circumstances where you think it would be better to teach reading not using a phonics-centric approach?
I think all kids will benefit from phonics, but what we know is that phonics is, it's kind of like training wheels. When you're getting started, phonics are essential, but as you get to be more proficient as a reader, you need more. You need to develop good comprehension skills. You need to develop writing skills, research skills, speaking skills. You need to understand how to distinguish between fake news and fact-based information on the internet. So we need a comprehensive approach to literacy. And what concerns me is this is a bit narrow and that it actually may harm kids in the future. Right now, 50% of Americans don't read a book in a single year. And that is a sign that as a nation, we're in trouble with respect to literacy.
We're talking with the dean of USC's Rossier School of Education, Pedro Nogueira. Also with us, Democratic State Assembly Member Blanca Rubio, who has introduced the bill which calls on California schools to use the science of reading approach, which is a phonic-based way to teach reading in public schools. I'd love to hear from you, your thoughts about this. We're at 866-893-5722. Particularly if you are a teacher, you've been a teacher, or you have thoughts particularly about having a particular phonics-based approach to reading versus others. We're at 866-893-5722. We're talking about Assembly Bill 2222, 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Assemblymember Rubio, you want to respond to the concerns of Dean Nogueira?
Absolutely. Hello, Dean Nogueira. So yes, I understand the concern about mandates, but in reality that we have mandates all the time. When a new curriculum is introduced, we only have three choices. Usually it's three choices, so that even though it's not a mandate, we only have the choice of three curricula. So I share your concern. I was in the classroom for 16 years, and that's why I'm working with the different advocate groups. And it is a mandate, but again, pretty much all of our curriculum, all of our state standards are mandates. And so I would love to work with you, Dean Nogueira, to make sure that we get this right, because at the end of the day, it's all about kids. It's about teaching kids how to read. And we can't just say, oh, well, this is not going to work. I was taught in my teacher preparation program that data and statistics was the way to identify learning gaps. And I believe that the science of reading has done that research. And we can join forces to make sure that I get this bill correct and that we do what's best for students. Currently, California is 48th in our literacy rate. Mississippi used to be 49th, and they've implemented the science of reading, and they're currently at their 22nd in the nation. And so something's happening in Mississippi. And I know that with talent, the talent that we have within our teachers, our schools, if we all decide that this is something that will help our kids, I think at the end of the day, it's about helping children. And I expressed that I am a second language learner, and we have a lot of that population that's falling through the cracks. And so a database science-based program, I think, is the key to at least start gaining ground on our status as 48th in the nation.
I want to ask you, Pedro Noguera, about what the assembly member just mentioned about that there is science behind, research behind this approach that would be mandated in her bill. One of the critiques of the ways that we've taught reading historically is that we haven't done very good research on it. Even the research that's been touted hasn't been particularly high quality. And I wonder if you can speak to that issue. Do we have multiple methods for teaching reading that really bear fruit based on research?
Yeah, so I agree that the science of reading is on, you know, there's solid research behind it and it's evidence-based, but it is important to look back at what happened with Open Court, which was a phonics-based curriculum. And, you know, it didn't bring about the lift that we hoped for. And that's because it's not good enough to simply mandate a curriculum. You then have to provide support to teachers in schools to work with kids in their classrooms. If you don't do that, then you can mandate all kinds of things and not see the results. Many of our schools lack the personnel, lack the training to provide, to do this work well. And as I said, if we look at what happened with Open Court, a lot of kids got stuck because simply mastering phonics will not make you a fluent reader. And that's one of the things that concerns me when we overemphasize phonics at the expense of other aspects of literacy.
Let's take a listener call from Nadra in Burbank. You're on Air Talk. What do you think?
Hi, I think this is a horrible idea. They've done this in other states. They're driving away teachers out of the industry because you're trying to tie their hands. Let's treat them like professionals. We can give them professional development without mandating, and let's pay them. They're underfunded, they're underpaid as they are, and our schools are underfunded, and this is not the way that we get a highly literate society. We have to fully fund our education system. I live in Burbank, and our teachers have not had a raise. They just are now getting a raise after, like, something ridiculous, like 6 or 7 years of not having a raise. And now you're going to write a law to tie their hands in class and what they can do? Just watch them leave like they're doing in other states. I think this is a horrible idea, and I think there's other ways, other things that we can do to improve outcomes for our students.
Nadra, thank you for your calls. Carolyn Beverly Hills says, I understand the assembly members' concerns and wanting to mandate so that we're focused on phonics and skill building, but I also understand there's a lack of training once curriculum is adopted. The teachers need to be trained to perceive when a child is struggling. Carol, thank you for that. Assembly Member Rubio, your response to the two listener comments.
Yes, so absolutely. The training, as a matter of fact, is part of the bill, is making sure that teachers and administrators get the proper training, but also to include the science of reading in the teacher credentialing programs. So when I'm going to school to get a credential, that would be part of the curriculum to make sure that the teachers are taught how to do this. And, you know, we're calling it a mandate, but again, I want to remind us that everything is a mandate. Again, when you have three programs to choose from, it's not necessarily free choice because you have three that are only allowed to be chosen from. And to respond to the Open Court discussion, I taught Open Court, and I absolutely correct that it's not the solve-all. It was phonics-based, but I transitioned to fourth grade, and we continued with the reading skills, the comprehension skills in fourth grade. Now, the problem is that one district is doing one program, the other district is doing another program, and then a third district is doing a third program. And I taught in a high-poverty school, Fontana Unified, where I had a third of the students were African-American, a third Latino, and a third white. What they had in common was that they were all poor. And a lot of those poor communities tend to have kids that move from school to school. And so if you have Open Court in one school and you know, the other two programs at the other schools, the kids are having to relearn, and the teachers, it's actually more difficult for teachers because now they have to catch them up. And so as a classroom teacher, I can tell you that, yes, they are correct. We struggle with teaching kids that are far behind. However, if we don't start with a science-based, research-based program that can be implemented across the districts, it won't matter what program you're teaching, because the skills that you are teaching are consistent throughout California. And another comment about teachers getting paid. Absolutely, we want to pay teachers, but that's different than trying to teach kids. We can have the conversation on how underpaid teachers are, because I was a teacher. But I think that consistency is key. I think if we implement the teacher credential programs to make sure that they teach the science of reading, we provide the professional development for the teachers. As a classroom teacher, every week we had professional development. So this can be easily implemented into our regular professional development days. And, working with the Department of Education is, in fact, the key to make sure that we're all on the same page.
Okay. I want to thank you, Blanca Rubio, Democratic State Assembly member of West Covina and surrounding communities, who introduced Assembly Bill 2222, which would require schools in California, public schools, to teach the science of reading, a phonics-based approach. Joan in Anaheim said, "My oldest kid took a while to get into phonics. As a result, struggled. I have younger kids who took a phonics approach. They did great." So Joan pointing out what she sees as the different approaches that did or didn't work with her kids. Thanks so much for your comments. Our thanks as well to Pedro Noguera, Dean of USC's Rossier School of Education. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we're going to talk about the re-election of El Salvador's president. We'll find out what people there think about his leadership and what some critics around the world are saying about his methods. Back in a minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with the author of Beverly Hills Spy, the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor. Ronald Drapkin will be with us coming up in just a few minutes. But right now, we turn our attention to the recent El Salvador presidential election, in which Nayib Bukele was reelected in a landslide. It was reportedly a 70% margin for the last leg of the ballots that were collected. The reelection's highly controversial, considering presidents have been unable to run for consecutive presidential terms until a 2021 Supreme Court decision in El Salvador. That was made by judges who Bukele put in office at the start of his term. There's also been criticism from human rights organizations about the way he's cracked down on crime that was rampant in El Salvador, but finding about 1% of the country's population behind bars in the wake of his action. Joining us to talk about Bukele's leadership is assistant professor in political science at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York, Lucas Perello. Thank you very much, Professor Perello, for joining us on Air Talk. Is this a trustworthy election result? Is this really indicative of the popularity of Bukele?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here. And I would say that the election result that we saw a couple of weeks ago is truly indicative of how popular President Bukele currently is in El Salvador. In the most recent presidential election, he won approximately with 85% of votes. The runner-up, candidate from the left-wing and traditional party, the FMLN, was backed with barely 6.4% of votes. And according to his victory speech, President Bukele expects that his political party, New Ideas, will win up to 58 of the 60 seats in the country's unicameral legislature.
And how much of this popularity and political dominance relates to his crackdown on gang activity?
Well, Mr. Bukele's popularity comes down, I would say, to a single factor, and that is El Salvador's stunning crime drop, which is a consequence of his crackdown on crime. Now, for decades, maras, or gangs, terrorized the local population in El Salvador through threats, extortion, and murders. The most famous gangs were Mara Salvatrucha and Mara Barro 18. And what Bukele did once he became president was that he adopted iron fist policies. More specifically, on March 27, 2022, he asked the country's legislative assembly to pass or declare a month-long state of emergency. This suspends constitutional rights and also makes it easier for the security apparatus, including the police and the military, to make arrests, which in theory were supposedly against the gangs. Now, the Legislative Assembly has renewed the state of emergency every month or on a monthly basis. Now, I think it's important to take a look at the numbers in this case. Since he took office back in 2019, intentional homicide rates have decreased from 38 per 100,000 inhabitants that year to 7.8 per 100,000 inhabitants in 2022. That is very well below the African American average.
Yeah.
Absolutely, it is.
Wow.
So much of his popularity does stem from his successful crackdown on crime.
How has he accomplished that?
Well, he's basically done this through the state of emergency, which is renewed on a monthly basis by the national legislature. Now, what the state of assembly again implies is that it does suspend constitutional rights and it loosens the rules that you are required to make arrests. And basically what's happened here is that the state of emergency has suspended basic civil liberties and security forces have locked up approximately 75,000 people in El Salvador. That is, I would say, I think 1.7% of the country's population, or 1 in 45 adults, is currently now in prison. So what we've seen in El Salvador in these last years is that there's been this marked crackdown on crime that has specifically targeted the gangs, but has also led to other consequences within the country. There's also a lot of reports being made right now about violations of human rights taking place in El Salvador, about people who are innocent who are also being detained in these mass arrests. So there's, I would say, two different sides to the story. One that, yes, the policies have effectively been able to crack down on crime, but on the other hand, there's also important consequences for, and this has also affected individuals who were not necessarily participants, right? In the gangs or participants in crime activities in the country.
Now, for their family members who might be speaking out in their defense and saying, you know, my son or my husband, you know, we're not involved in criminal activity, are they able to make their case to the public or is that squelched?
Well, that's it's difficult. I would say that what we've seen in El Salvador during the state of emergency, or as a consequence of the state of emergency, is that both police and soldiers have routinely arrested citizens, and they also send them to prison indefinitely without necessarily providing a reason. And in many cases that I talked to, because I was in El Salvador during the election, many of the people who are sent to prison don't have access to a lawyer, and they don't also have access to communication with their loved ones or their family members. So the situation for those who have been arrested, especially for the families of those who have been arrested at this moment, is quite complicated.
Professor, thank you very much for being with us and giving us the very latest on the election results and the popularity of President Bukele in El Salvador. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you. That's Lucas Berejo, who is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Also joining us, and quite close to home, from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, Assistant Professor of History, Andrea Oñate Madrazo. Professor Oñate Madrazo, so good to have you back with us. We appreciate it.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me back on. It's great to be able to speak with you today.
I was just
with your listeners, of course.
Sure. I was just wondering if you have any sense of Salvadoran Americans, how they're responding. And I ask that because, you know, I remember back when Duterte was elected in the Philippines, and there are a lot of concerns about him being a strong man and the way that he used police power in the Philippines. But in so many conversations that I had with Southern California Filipinos, there was a lot of support for him. Like, he's bringing law and order to our home country, and our family members there are safer. There was a lot of support. Do you see that kind of thing among the Salvadoran communities of Southern California?
Yeah, Larry. I want to just preface by saying that I myself am not Salvadoran, although I very much love the country and have studied it for many years. But I think that you're absolutely right. By and large, Salvadorans in the United States and in Southern California support Bukele in a reflection of how Salvadorans living in El Salvador support him for exactly the reasons that you're saying, right? They are hearing back from their families about how they are now feeling safe. They are no longer needing to pay what was called rentas, which was essentially a tax to these gangs. Anyone that had any type of commerce was a victim of that extortion, essentially. And they are, those that are living here that are able to travel back are able to go and, you know, be in their country, travel around their country by car, send remittances, and trust that those remittances are going to go to their families. So the support that Bukele has transcends national borders for exactly the reasons that you brought up. Yes.
And then there are the human rights issues, which Professor Pareo talked about. And, you know, what, just to elaborate on that a bit, what are some of the concerns about, first of all, him getting a second 6-year term, mm-hmm. the changing of the Constitution? We were just talking with some guests about a documentary that's Oscar nominated this year for about what the same thing that happened in Uganda, and, you know, where the mm-hmm. where the terms are changed so that the president can stay on indefinitely. So what are the concerns of human rights activists about President Bukele doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, there was a constitutional change in 2021 to allow for immediate re-election, essentially for Bukele to be able to be re-elected consecutively. That was not permitted before. And there were some modifications that had to be made so that he could take essentially a leave of absence from his functions as president so he could devote himself to the campaign. And that was, as your first speaker, Lucas Perello, said, controversial in the sense that people in the country that are members of the opposition were pushing back against this and the legality of it. El Salvador now has a limit where theoretically Bukele would not be able to run again. Having said that, Bukele now controls the people that are making the laws, and he therefore has the ability to the Constitution, and many suspect, and I think rightfully so, that that is something that will happen if his popularity continues over, he has an extra 5 years, a 5-year mandate, that he may choose to do that to perpetuate himself in power. And there are serious human rights concerns, as you mentioned, and some of these numbers that Lucas Perello was giving us about, you know, the number of people that are in jail, one in 45 adults. El Salvador has now the highest rate of incarceration in the world. There is a center for the confinement of terrorism in Tecoluca, San Vicente, where many of these prisoners have been taken. And there's a lot of pushback from human rights advocates, from family members of these detained. Lawyers are saying that, you know, they don't really have access to their clients. The judicial processes to try these alleged gang members and terrorists are quite opaque. There's no real sort of transparency in the criminal justice system anymore. There's been some very suspicious deaths that have happened in prisons under pretty strange circumstances. So that is a reality that human rights and also democracy in the sense of checks and balances, democracy in the sense of divisions of power, an independent judiciary have all taken a very big hit. And you mentioned, you know, Duterte in the Philippines, you also mentioned Uganda. I think one of the things that is so interesting about El Salvador that goes beyond El Salvador is that it's a microcosm for something that I'm observing as a historian. We tend to take kind of longer views on what's happening, that I'm observing happening in many places around the world, which is that the value that maybe someone like you or I place on democracy, on all these things like checks and balances, independent branches of government, procedural elections, term limits, et cetera, don't have an intrinsic value for everyone in the way that I think we assumed for a very long time. And that is one of the reasons that we can explain Bukele's over 80% approval rating. Some even put the number at 90% approval rating in El Salvador. And it's that for many Salvadorans, the vast majority of them, security, when they've been in a situation of such terror for so many years, takes priority.
They may feel like the democratic principle, the earlier democratic principles are a luxury. They're so desperate for personal safety that's a trade-off they're willing to make. But of course, the question is, if they're willing to make that now, are they going to be willing to make that in the future, particularly if there's a further erosion of democratic rights? What happens if journalists aren't able to report on what's happening in prisons and what's happening with the legal system? And I need to wrap, but just real quickly, Professor, to what extent are journalists able to cover this?
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's a very slippery slope. Because there's no guarantee of what's going to happen within the next 5 years or the next 10 when we erode these institutions and basically dismiss their value, we are left in an unknown, uncharted territory. And the independence of the media and the ability to report on this is already suffering. One of the primary Salvador newspapers that has been reporting negatively on some of these human rights abuses, they reported that perhaps Bukele had struck a deal with the gangs. That's a separate issue, which we don't have time to discuss. They're now operating from Costa Rica because they were not able to do their job and they were getting all sorts of threats and persecutions in El Salvador. Wow. So from a different lens, but you know, we've seen these strong men come in, erode democratic institutions, and the media is one of the first things to go.
El Faro is that publication you were just referring to. Professor, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. That's Andrea Oñate Madrazo, Assistant Professor of History at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, the remarkable story of a hero of World War I moves to Hollywood, hobnobs with celebrities, while serving as an intelligence agent for the Japanese military, feeding information prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor. We'll talk with the author of the book, Beverly Hills Spy, Ronald Drapkin, when we come back in just 90 seconds.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Frederick Rutland was the first pilot to take off and land an airplane on a ship. He did it during the largest naval battle of World War I. It gave Rutland a high profile in his home country of England. He went on to become an authority on aircraft carriers and military planes. An inspirational story, if that was his full legacy. The complexity of Frederick Rutland's life is told in Ronald Drapkin's new book, Beverly Hills Spy, the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor. Ronald, so good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry.
So Rutland's life is incredible, but it's also fascinating how you ended up writing this book. Tell us how it began as a search for information about your grandfather's associates.
I grew up on the west side of Los Angeles, and I sort of knew always that my father had worked in U.S. intelligence. Didn't get a lot of details.
Didn't get more than that, but
didn't get a lot of details, but he and his old army buddies would get together, and they'd talk about, chasing communists around Los Angeles in the old days. And after he passed away, I was going through his things, and I had clues that my grandfather was also in intelligence. I was thinking maybe my dad got a job through connections.
Family business.
Yeah. And there was a pandemic on, you might recall, and I was kind of bored. And so I started filing information requests with the FBI on all these spies in old-time Los Angeles. And the one on Frederick Rutland came back. It's funny, when the FBI sends you the reply to a Freedom of Information request, there's actually only two possible answers. One is, here you go. And two is, we have nothing for you. And when they have something for you, they don't say, we just declassified, this is really hot stuff. You just get it. And I was reading this thing. It had just been declassified.
Wow.
And I was like, holy moly.
Your timing was incredible to get this information. So Rutland had this extraordinary life. I mentioned about where he was a pioneer during World War I. And so he's well known in Britain after World War I?
Very famous. Multiple gold medals. His name was Rutland from the Battle of Jutland. And I think that just really helped it go viral back then.
Yeah, because that was the biggest naval battle of the war, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So that had a ring to it. But he also had some aspects of his life that garnered less sympathetic coverage, like what was called wife swapping.
Yes.
When his wife got involved with a friend of his and he got involved with the friend's wife.
Yeah, that was for a British officer in the 1910s, 20s. That was just not done.
Yeah. And so did that start to a bit erode his reputation, would you say?
Yeah. He already was having a few issues due to his very strident personality and his lower class upbringing. His colleagues were more like Oxford, Cambridge, upper class folks, and he was not. And with the wife swapping, they really were starting to have problems with him after the war ended.
And let's talk about how class plays into the military, because it seems to me this is a big part of the story, as you tell it in Beverly Hills Spy. So he comes, from a low-income background. But, who are the people that he's relating to during the war in military service?
Yeah, he was, as you were saying, Larry, he was a poor-born, lower-class fellow who had grown up overlooking a naval base. And he had only joined the Royal Navy as an enlisted sailor, a 14-year-old who had lied about his age to get in there. And he had become a pilot, an officer, and a war hero out of sheer competence, intelligence, and drive. And so here he is, this low-class fellow, and he's surrounded by all these upper-class Englishmen. And
sort of born and bred to the Royal Navy.
Yeah, exactly. And he just wasn't really fitting in.
All right. And so he finds himself stymied in advancing militarily. What leads him to cozy up to Japanese military officials?
He was just really getting angry at his treatment, his perceived mistreatment due to class or you know, whatever.
Or his personality. I guess it's hard to know which is how much was one and the other.
Yeah, it's hard to know. But class was certainly a big part of it. And he's frustrated. He's trying to decide what to do. He's not the most ethical guy in the world. And the Imperial Japanese Navy had an office in London, in Westminster. And one day he just walked in there. These Japanese were looking for British aircraft technology. He walks in and he says, "Hello, I'd like to speak with you. My name is Rutland." And the Japanese officers there said, "We know exactly who you are, and come on in."
Wow. And so this expertise that he's garnered through his sheer being close to the technology, studying it, being someone who was consulted, he starts sharing information about aircraft carriers. Now, is there anything illegal about this when he starts doing it?
It's tricky. It's tricky. In theory, it was not. But the Japanese came up with a little bit of a clever lie to the British that the British never figured out. And they offered him a contract from the Mitsubishi Corporation. That was a subterfuge. He was actually working directly for the Imperial Japanese Navy. And the British didn't know that. And that would have definitely been illegal.
And what was the compensation he was being provided by the Japanese Royal Navy?
It was unbelievable. You know, I've worked with a lot of folks who are currently on active duty in the Japanese naval forces today, and they've pulled all the documents back then. And his compensation was roughly 10x the highest paid Japanese admiral.
Wow. Now, and I know you got a hold of some books, some like memoirs from military leaders in Japan back during World War I. Is that right? That had long gone out of print or were never actually published?
Yeah, exactly. The Japanese side of the story was thought to have been lost because right after the A bombings and the capitulation of Japan, the Japanese burned a lot of their espionage files. They thought correctly that they'd be on trial and they burned them. And the story was thought to be lost. However, a lot of these Japanese officers wrote their memoirs, and they probably wrote them in the 1950s. Maybe they sold 50 copies, and my colleagues found them.
All right. We're talking with the author of Beverly Hills Spy, the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor, Ronald Drapkin, with us to talk about the story of Frederick Rutland, who actually came to Los Angeles with his second wife. What brought him to L.A. and a home in the Hollywood Hills?
Yeah, the Japanese really appreciated his efforts. He had helped design their aircraft carriers, all sorts of things. And in the 30s, really, Los Angeles was their key espionage target. You know, we had in L.A. a few things, primarily 70% of aircraft production, as well as the U.S. Pacific
Fleet. Port complex, yeah.
Yeah, Lockheed here in Burbank, you know, Douglas, all these things. And they really wanted to know what was going on with the latest U.S. aircraft and Navy.
What was the cover story Rutland had for moving here?
He just told people he was an international businessman, and he kind of left it a little vague.
The old description of, yeah, right. Did they question where his wealth came from?
He just, you know, bold as brass, cool as cucumber, just told him he was a rich British thing. And, you know, us Americans, Angelenos, we kind of have a thing for British accents.
Oh,
You know, it's delivered with this British accent.
And we confer higher intelligence, greater culture, all kinds of positives.
Yeah. When the FBI was tracking Rutland later, you know, their files will say he denotes breeding.
We'll continue our conversation with Ronald Drapkin, author of Beverly Hills Spy, the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So glad to have you with us. We're talking with Ronald Drapkin, author of Beverly Hills Spy, the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor. That man is Frederick Rutland, who settled in Los Angeles with his wife and kids, a home in the Hollywood Hills. He's hobnobbing with celebrities like Charlie Chaplin and Boris Karloff, and he's there at start of a group called the British United Services Club, which is still in existence in Altadena. But this brought Rutland into contact with British military folk. What were some of the things you suspect or found out that he learned from them?
What he would do is he would just have these parties, and he'd invite in his friends, the celebrities, the Boris Karloffs and Nigel Bruces and even Charlie Chaplin from time to time, and he'd bring in the U.S. admirals from the Pacific Fleet and the American aircraft manufacturing executives. And, you know, espionage sounds a little tricky, but it could be as easy as getting someone drunk and asking them questions.
And they just think he's a curious, smart guy. Probably doesn't occur to him he'd be working for the Japanese Naval Intelligence.
It would be the last thing in the world they would suspect.
Yeah. So at he's funneling this information to Japanese military leaders. And at what point does he start getting cold feet?
He starts getting cold feet in 1939 when he takes his daughter with him to, he's going to report out to his handlers in Tokyo. Stays in the Imperial Hotel over there, the Frank Lloyd Wright designed hotel. And Germany invades Poland, and Japan becomes just martial, and there's troops everywhere. And he thinks he's been really smart up to this point, taking their money for really just taking people out drinking and telling what's going on. And he starts to think, holy moly, there really could be a war here.
Yeah, and so he's British, he's not American, so maybe he's less concerned about what happens to the United States.
Yeah.
But is he starting to think about what this means for Britain, especially as it's dealing with, you know, the war in Europe?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there's his country's in a war. He's not involved this time. And he realized there could be a war between Japan and the U.S., and he'd be on, quote unquote, the wrong side.
How does he, to that point, justify this? Like, he's, so what does he think Japan is going to use this information for that he's giving on Southern California Naval and Aircraft Facility? How does he think that they might use that would be benign?
I don't think he's really thinking about that much. He's just having a grand old time. He's talking to admirals and talking to executives and checking out the latest technology and really kind of a legend in his own mind.
You're writing about what happens as we approach the attack on Pearl Harbor, and you very effectively describe he's like scurrying around. He's trying to find where to go, and he has connections in Mexico, and question is where is he going to be able to travel. He finds himself back in England, and how is he greeted there?
Well, he expects to be able to go back to England and become a hero again. And it was a subterfuge again. MI6 and the FBI got together and they said, we need this guy out of Los Angeles. It's just a tremendous embarrassment. And the plane lands in Ireland where it goes to refuel. And he lands there and they take his passport and they take his documents from him. And he's like, whoa, what's going on here?
Yeah. And he ends up in custody in the UK. I wonder, though, about all the information that when he got cold feet and then he started working with American officials, telling them about his concerns of an attack coming. What did they do once he became a double agent, essentially?
Well, you know, the U.S. Navy and the FBI were not on the same page in this case. The Navy was, basically believed him, but the FBI did not.
Right. And why was this all sort of pushed under the rug by J. Edgar Hoover?
You know, the who was to blame for Pearl Harbor has been an never-ending story here. And this was really embarrassing. You know, he was operating in the clear in Los Angeles for about 8 or 9 years. Then he had offered to help the U.S. Navy, and the FBI silenced him about his warnings about the coming attack from the Japanese Navy. So this was very, very embarrassing to the FBI, and so they kept it quiet. They covered it up.
What was the embarrassment to the FBI? Just that for so long he was funneling this information to Japanese officials?
Well, there was that, but it was also that he tried to help the U.S. Navy and warn them about what was coming, and the FBI had him silenced.
Okay, because the FBI wasn't providing the same. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what was the embarrassment in this for the FBI?
If this had hit the LA Times back then that this British war hero had been not only spying for the Japanese, but had been trying to warn the FBI about Pearl Harbor and they had ignored it, it would have been very embarrassing.
And this fits in, of course, to the larger scholarship of, you know, why, with ample warning and concerns about the potential for a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, why there was not a concerted effort to follow up. Looking at the additional information that you've gleaned from Rutland, what's your thought about that?
Yeah, I think it's very clear, you know, that the initial fault for Pearl Harbor was blamed on the admiral and the general on the scene. And there was quite a bit of blame in Washington as well. And I think most historians are, you know, have come to accept this.
Okay. We're talking with the author of Beverly Hills Spy, Ronald Drapkin. The book subtitled The Double Agent War Hero Helped Japan Attack Pearl Harbor. Did his wife have any knowledge of what, I mean, she had to wonder where this money was coming from.
Yeah, I'm absolutely positive that she knew exactly what was going on. The FBI just didn't think that way.
Yeah.
At the time.
They just assumed, well, how would she possibly know?
How would she possibly know? There's actually a quote, one of the FBI agents said that he's not the kind of person that would confide in a woman, which is just, you know, in our current sensibilities, that's the most ridiculous statement ever.
And then take us to the final years of his life. So he's released, he's living in England. What were his final years like?
He had been silenced and put in prison without trial, and he was a tremendously bitter man. He was very angry about his treatment. He had been angry about his treatment the whole time, but even more so. And he was trying to redeem himself. He was writing letters. He was kind of harassing the MI5 agents. But at some point, he just decided it wasn't worth it anymore and decided to end it all.
And he wrote letters, I know, to his kids, telling them in advance what he was going to do.
Yes. Yeah. And it was, they're sort of tragic letters if you read them.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about this incredible story. The book is absolutely fascinating. You mentioned one of the scenes where Rutland takes his daughter to the hotel in Japan and everything's changed. He's taking her for what he thinks he's going to be a good dad, and they're going to see the beautiful city and the architecture, and this whole pall has fallen over Tokyo. You do such a great job of describing it. I kind of got chills as I was reading it. So thank you again. Appreciate you being with us. Beverly Hills Spy, the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Just want to let you know, coming up on Monday for President's Day, we're off, but we have a very special 2 hours on President's Day devoted to Academy Award nominated films and the people in those movies. Sandra Hüller of Anatomy of a Fall, Alexander Payne, director of The Holdovers, Coleman Domingo of Rustin, Christopher Nolan, director of Oppenheimer, Celine Song of Past Lives, and more are a part of that 2 hour special Monday at 9. Make sure you catch it.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, our week-long series devoted to love looks at sex and its importance, or in some cases, lack of importance in romantic relationships. We'll hear from listeners, what role does sex play in your love relationship, and what level of priority do you give it? That's coming up on Air Talk. And if you've been with someone for a long period of time, has that evolved over time in one direction or the other? We'll hear about that from listeners coming up. Austin, very fortunate this week because he's filling in all days except today's, my lone day hosting this week. And he gets to talk about so many different aspects of love in this Valentine's week. So very, very nice. We turn our attention now to short-term rental housing in unincorporated Los Angeles. The LA County Board of Supervisors have been struggling with this issue as elected bodies have been essentially in any desirable part of the world, I think, because with Airbnb and Vrbo short-term rentals, you have the opportunity, of course, for people who are property owners to maybe help pay their mortgage or bring in some extra income. The flip side of that is what it can mean to communities with houses turned into party houses and all the downside of not having the kind of stable residential community they've been used to. Well, joining us to update us on what the supervisors of LA County have done is LAist reporter covering housing, David Wagner. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what specifically is the board looking at doing here?
Yeah, so the county's Board of Supervisors voted yesterday to advance these new regulations for short-term rentals. This would only apply to unincorporated parts of LA County, so, you know, limited geography here. The upshot is that the rules would, ban hosts on platforms like Airbnb and Vrbo from renting out properties that they don't personally live in. And like you said, these plans have been in the works since 2019. They still need another vote before finally taking effect, but this has been the biggest step they've taken so far.
And what kind of public response have they gotten at the supervisors' meetings? I assume competing thoughts from stakeholders.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of speakers, people that I interviewed for this story, were in favor of these rules. You know, they say that they've seen ordinary family-owned homes in their neighborhoods turn into basically businesses where people are buying up these properties. They're renting them out to people who come and party and disrupt the community, make noise, and, you know, take away housing that could be reserved for homeowners, for renters. So there are definitely people in favor of these rules. There were other people that lined up to say, you know, hey, I'm not some Airbnb mogul. I'm just renting out, you know, maybe my backyard granny flat to make some extra income. And these rules could potentially stop me from doing that. The rules, you know, they do limit people to only renting out their primary residence. So you couldn't, you know, rent out investment properties, second homes. In some cases, the way the rules are written right now, you couldn't even rent out that backyard ADU. The supervisors are still discussing this. We'll see how the rules morph and change before the final vote. But that was a big concern for a lot of speakers, saying, you know, I should be able to rent out my ADU if I'm on site to deal with issues that might come up with guests.
Now, they can still do, of course, a long-term ADU rental. It's just this the short-term rentals that they would not be to do. A couple weeks ago, we talked about this being a huge issue in Palm Springs, where they put a cap on the number of permits based on the districts, because residents, you know, were concerned people were buying their second homes in Palm Springs and essentially financing that through significant numbers of short-term rentals to help pay the mortgage. So I assume part of this, that's why we're talking about only primary residents being allowed to do this. They don't want people essentially running this as a business.
That's right. That's the goal that the county supervisors are outlining here. And, you know, the extent to which short-term rentals fuel LA's housing crisis, that's been a subject of much research and debate. There have been studies looking at the impacts of short-term rentals, you know, taking away apartments and homes from the long-term rental and home buying market. Companies like Airbnb and Vrbo have, you know, disputed some of those findings. So this is an issue that has been a big deal in LA, Palm Springs, other, as you say, in-demand areas.
Yeah, desirable areas, quote-unquote, because people want to visit and want to rent units. David Wagner, LAist reporter covering housing. We reached out to Vrbo and Airbnb, invited them to join our conversation. Airbnb responded to our request but was unable to make a company representative available for this segment. And as of our coming on air with the segment, we have not yet received a response from Vrbo. I'd like to hear from you. If you're someone who lives in an unincorporated area like Altadena, Marina del Rey, East Los Angeles, Topanga, you want to share your thoughts about this. If you're a property owner, if you see it infringing on your ability to rent your property, if you're a longtime resident and feel that short-term rentals have really damaged the quality of life in your community. Share your thoughts about where we stand on these proposed rental regulations. 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. Or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Erica in Topanga, good to have you with us. What do you think of the proposal?
Hi, thank you. I think as it's written, it will eliminate my ability to keep my home, which I live in. I'm a single mother. I started my life over in 2014. I bought my property that has a guest house on it with the intentions of being able to use my property for long-term affordability for myself and my daughter. This ordinance would tell me that I couldn't do what I've been doing, and that is rent out my house part-time throughout the year when my daughter's at her father's and go up and stay in my guest house. It says I can't do that. It says I have to live in my house with guests. Now, this ordinance, what it's trying to do is it's trying to just eliminate any type of way that we all are trying to make ends meet in Los Angeles, period. I wouldn't have purchased my home in the area I wanted to for my daughter to be raised if I didn't have that additional source of income.
Can you do a longer-term rental of your ADU and get anywhere near the amount of income as you do with short-term rentals?
Well, I mean, that would mean that I have to move out of my primary residence, my home, and rent out my main house.
I thought you said you had an ADU.
I do. I have a guest house. And
you could rent that out.
ADU
you?
Is different yeah. than a guest house.
Oh, okay.
Period.
Okay.
An
All right.
ADU is a additional, essentially, it has a kitchen, right? A guest house, you're not allowed to have a kitchen in there. It is a guest house. It's a granny flat. You are not allowed to collect rent on a guest house. I can't rent out my guest house per zoning lot. I could rent out my main house, and I scooch up to my guest house as the as
Got
laws
it.
Are now.
Yeah.
As long and I keep my eye on my home, and if any rules are broken, people are out. And, I lock up the rooms that I don't want them in, and that's fine. And that's really been my affordability when my daughter's been in her father's to be able to do so and pay property taxes and.
Erica, I really appreciate your call. Thank you for sharing the hardship this would present to you. David, she also mentioned enforcement. To what extent is the county going to be able to enforce this? Because I know in the city of L.A., it's been very challenging for them.
That's the big question, and we'll have to see how that shakes out. But you're right, these kinds of regulations have been on the books for years now in other parts of L.A., the city of Santa Monica, the city of L.A. Hosts can be fined quite a lot of money for each day that they violate rules in the city of L.A. But to be honest, enforcement has been spotty. Those citations, those fines have been pretty limited. Even proponents of these rules say that illegal activity in the city of L.A. is still pretty rampant, pretty common. Just over the weekend, L.A. police said that two people were shot at a home in the Hollywood Hills that was apparently being rented out for a Super Bowl party.
You, in the story that you wrote, you quote also a 2022 study, I believe it was, looking at listings in the city of L.A.
That's right.
And what did it show in terms of the legality of the listings?
Yeah, this was a study done by a McGill University urban planning professor, and it was, toward the end of 2022. He looked at listings in the city of LA and, based on different criteria, concluded that almost half of the listings that he could see on platforms like Airbnb appeared to be breaking the city's law.
All right. Mary in View Park emailed, "Our once quiet, cohesive block was ruined by the Airbnb house directly across the street. The owner of the property clearly values greed over respect for those of us who live on the block. We've seen, like others plagued with Airbnbs in their neighborhoods, loud parties, violence, parking woes, disdain from visitors, quote unquote, and a general disruption of this once peaceful place. I would love to see short-term rentals outlawed entirely." That's Mary in View Park. Lee in Altadena emailed, I have zero sympathy for anybody relying on short-term rental income to cover a mortgage. Homes were built in neighborhoods with zoning, not to be hotels. Just because somebody had an idea and created an app in a company doesn't mean it's okay to do it. And if there weren't rules in place when someone bought the home, they had every reason to expect it could happen. People who own homes in neighborhoods shouldn't be forced to endure what's essentially a tiny hotel just because someone else wants to earn that income. David in Altadena emailed, the worst part of this proposed legislation is the broad brush it paints across what is in fact a very, very diverse county. One size does not fit all. Topaz in Topanga says, I don't agree with the ordinance. It's an overreach. It feels like it's blaming people instead of empowering them economically. Michelle in Altadena, I think it's disappointing to see our Board of Supervisors make no changes despite hearing from homeowners in the community. One size fits all does not fit everyone, especially those with small units to rent. And Javier in Pasadena says, I totally support tougher regulations. As a renter myself, I've seen how the amount of housing has diminished because of so many short-term rentals. Let's talk with Sandra in Altadena. Good to have you with us, Sandra. What do you think of these proposed restrictions on Airbnbs in unincorporated LA County? Sandra, for some reason we're having trouble hearing you. Let's see if we can clean up that line while we talk with Melissa in Long Beach. Melissa, what do you think of this this ordinance?
Hi. Yeah, I think I'd like to speak on behalf of a community that depends on short-term rentals, and that's the childhood cancer community. My son is battling a really awful brain tumor, and we've had to move multiple places to be near different hospitals for his treatment. And we haven't had the ability to stay in a long-term lease, nor the ability to stay in a hotel because we needed, you know, amenities that a short-term rental can offer. So I just think that not everybody visiting a short-term rental is meaning to disrespect the property or party or have an impact on the community. Folks like us need these type of options and do respect others' homes. And again, not a one-size-fits-all that I heard another caller mention on. I think I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Melissa, thank you very much. We appreciate it. And we wish your son all the best in that ongoing treatment. Thank you so much. 866-893-5722. Sandra in Altadena, I think we've got you now. What do you think of this?
Hi, Larry. Yes. I live in Altadena, too. And I have a small cleaning business, and I clean ADUs, so it's a ripple effect. It not only affects the ADU person who's renting, but all the services that service the ADUs.
All right, Sandra, thank you so much. Linda in Los Feliz emailed, the reason the city council took this on is because so many of the rental houses have become party houses and wrecked neighborhood quality of life. If the owners of these homes had been more attentive to the behavior of tenants, this wouldn't have happened. There's no enforcement of this because in Los Angeles, the LAPD isn't tasked with enforcement. Who is enforcing? So who in the county would be enforcing, David?
I believe you'd have to register with the tax assessor and collector, and they would be overseeing this program. That is a question that has plagued some programs in other cities, though. In the city of LA, enforcement is, you know, citations and fines and enforcement are split between, you know, I believe the housing department, the planning department, other departments are involved. And it can be confusing for people to know who to complain to when they see this kind of activity in their neighborhood, when they think that rent control departments are being used as Airbnb listings, Vrbo listings. It's, you know, split, it's bifurcated, it's confusing.
Well, and if LAPD is coming out for calls of like disturbing the peace or things like that, LAPD would be, but they can't go any deeper than that. It's a whole other city department, which may not be staffed up to respond quickly. It, you know, who knows how long it's going to take them. That's got to be incredibly frustrating for residents.
Yeah, and I've heard in the past from people who say they've reached out repeatedly to various city departments in the city of LA and just really not heard anything back about their concerns.
Marie in Hawthorne emailed with with the new SoFi Stadium in Inglewood, it would be nice to rent an ADU or granny flat for short term for events, save hotel costs for fans. This new ruling would prevent the community in unincorporated areas, parts of Hawthorne and Lenox, from potential earnings that help them keep their property in this expensive area. David, thanks so much. So there's another reading of this ordinance, is that right?
Yeah, this is not a done deal. This is, I think, scheduled to come back in about a month. Another tiny little wrinkle just to mention on this, the California Coastal Commission is going to play a role in approving some of these rules in certain areas like Marina del Rey, Catalina Island, because they are also tasked with making sure that visitors can access low-cost accommodations along the coastline.
All right, David, thanks so much. We'll look forward to your continuing coverage at LAist.com as well as on all our programs here on LAist 89.3. David Wagner covers housing for LAist.
Thank you.
Thanks. Coming up on Air Talk, Love Week continues for Valentine's Week. Sex and love is our topic coming up. We're going to be talking about the role sex plays in your love relationship. And has that evolved over the years? Is sex a larger or smaller part of your relationship than it's been in the past? Does sex play really no role? And yet you have a very intimate, loving relationship, but sex is not really a part of it. I'd like to hear from you about how sex plays a role or doesn't in your loving relationship. We're at 866-893-5722. Back in a minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
I'm LAist senior education reporter Mariana Dale.
The communities that are more marginalized or that do not have access are the ones that are in most need.
I help families understand, navigate, and engage with the forces that shape education from kindergarten through high school.
How do I explain to my daughter that the same day you got to celebrate a birthday, you got to celebrate the day your mama left?
And I make space for students to tell their own stories.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
It's Love Week on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I'm no Barry White, though. But we're going to talk about sex and what role it has in loving relationships. And of course, as in everything else with relationships, highly customizable, and people have different priorities and different aspects of their primary intimate relationship. I'd like to hear from you, particularly if the role of sex in your relationship has evolved over the years, and if sex is an extremely important part of your relationship. I'd be interested in hearing why, what you see as the practical function it serves in the relationship, aside from the recreational joys of sex, and if it's something that is not really a big part of your intimate relationship, how that feels to you, and whether you feel anything missing or not, or whether it's just it just really doesn't serve an important function at this point. We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Joining me is Kinsey Institute educated sex educator Emily Nagoski, who's author of Come Together, The Science and Art of Creating Lasting Sexual Connections. Emily, thanks so much. Good to have you with us today.
It's my pleasure to talk to you.
So let's talk first of all about, I'm presuming there's no right or wrong here, that relationships are almost infinitely customizable. Do you think that there's any shoulds when it comes to sex in an intimate relationship?
Absolutely, there are no shoulds. One of the things you hear sex educators say all the time is we need to stop shoulding on ourselves. There is no right or wrong. There's just what works for you.
We should spell
in this
that
relationship
out.
And this season, shoulding, shoulding.
You have good diction, so that's okay. Yeah. Do you think that there are a lot of couples who, for whom maybe sex has never been a huge part, or over the years sex has become less a part of it, that there are feelings of guilt or failure that even if both partners agree and are okay with that, feelings that something's wrong with them doing that?
Absolutely. There are cultural messages that surround us everywhere saying that sex is supposed to be a huge part of our lives. All of us are supposed to want, like, and have a lot of sex. And that's just not reality. For some couples, by choice, sex is not a priority in their relationship. Goodness knows we have plenty of other things to fill up our time and attention. And there are couples for whom sex is a priority, and because our lives can be very stressful, it has dropped down the priority list until life becomes more susceptible to creating an environment where our brains can access pleasure.
We're talking with Emily Nagoski, author of Come Together, The Science and Art of Creating Lasting Sexual Connections. Also with us, a frequent guest on Air Talk, John Sovic, a queer therapist and coach who specializes in working with LGBT plus communities. He works on creating sex positive and affirming relationships. John, so good to have you back with us.
It's nice to be back. And it's fascinating, too, because as a queer person, I grew up in a world where there wasn't necessarily a framework, a design, a plan for how I was supposed to have relationships in my life. For a lot of cisgender and straight people, I mean, you get this manual and you're born basically says this is how it's supposed to be. And what that does is it opens up a really unique prospect to create our own version in queer relationships of sex and intimacy and love. And I think that's actually really exciting.
Well, let's take one aspect. So for gay men, for example, are there certain cultural shoulds and shouldn'ts and expectations around sex within gay male relationships?
Well, I think there's a kind of a misunderstanding of kind of a hypersexualized understanding of gay male relationships. But just like Emily said, each person is going to decide what their relationship is going to look like, how they want to relate, how they want to bring sex into that relationship. For some people, sex is not a big part of it. For others, it's a really big part, and they have to learn how to negotiate, to talk about it, to understand each other's needs, and find a way to build a bridge of how sex is going to work for them and how they're going to connect it to love.
All right. So I really want to hear from you as an Air Talk listener. This program will rise and fall on listeners sharing their firsthand experiences. So I know you might be a little shy in talking about sex and the place that it holds in your relationship, but I'm really interested in getting your input on the importance of sex in your relationship. What do you see as the benefit it provides to your relationship, again, beyond just the pleasure of the moment? And if you're someone for whom sex is not a big part of your relationship, share with us what are some of the other things that maybe come to the fore instead of sex and you would think of as more definitive of ways of bonding in your relationship. 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Jessica in Pasadena emailed, "I didn't think sex was that important in long-term relationships until I had great sex. After being married for a decade, I'm now in a 10-year relationship with a man who's interested in my pleasure. And now I think sex is very important. I want to have sex with him a lot because my pleasure is a priority as well as his. Having good sex with a partner is one of the fastest ways to intimacy for me." That's Jessica in Pasadena, 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Emily Nagoski, I wonder if you want to respond to what Jessica wrote to us.
Yes, especially with reference to the idea of queer relationships versus heterosexual relationships. The research has been remarkably consistent for a couple of decades now that people in heterosexual relationships have lower quality sex, they have fewer orgasms, they have less sexual and relationship satisfaction than people in non-heterosexual type relationships. So I have an entire chapter specifically about the patriarchy.
What's your theory about? Yeah, your theory about that. So it's largely women's dissatisfaction that skews that number?
It's sort of, But the way that the gender scripts that we absorb affect us are just as toxic to cisgender men in this system. But they have been trained that they're not allowed to notice the ways that they are dissatisfied, the ways they've been cut off from their longing for intimacy, their experience of loneliness, their longing for their own pleasure, as opposed to sex as a performance to prove their masculinity. Everybody is less satisfied in this system. And the more they fight against those rules and regulations, the better off they are, which a lot of queer couples have already done. A lot of that self-liberation and relationship liberation, because their relationship already violates so many of the rules that they were taught early in their lives they're supposed to follow.
John?
Well, it's interesting too, because I think the beautiful word that Jessica said is pleasure. That she and her partner are searching for pleasure together. And that's part of what happens sometimes in long-term relationships. As Emily was saying, we do get distracted by life. We have children, we have jobs, we have stress, we have mortgages. And all of those things distract from this really amazing human thing that our bodies can do, which is experience pleasure. These wonderful chemicals get thrown out into our body when we have sex and when we connect with someone through intimacy. And it's so important to have these conversations with our partner is what pleasures us, what pleasures you, and how can we make that a vital part of our relationship and use that as an expression of our love for each other.
And it seems to me that, and again, I understand that there are many relationships for which sex is not not something that really is a part of the relationship. I think that's fine. I think one of the advantages of sex is there is in the communication of the physical act or acts of sex, there is something that's bonding in a way other than just other physical manifestations or words. And I wonder, Emily, maybe you can speak to that. What is the power of sex in its reinforcement of intimacy?
The magic that can happen during an erotic encounter is this sense of your individual identity dissolving into a shared identity and even into a universal identity, and the chemistry underlying the experience absolutely is part of it. I will say it's not that different from experiences we can have dancing with other people or singing with other people, but because we are mammals, we have access to this particular route of experiencing a sense of union with the universe that is really good for our health.
And yeah, and there's a physical reaction that other things that we do, it's not quite the same. I know there's runner's high, there are other different, you know, oxytocin releasing things, but sex is sort
and
of the pinnacle.
Pleasure specifically, yeah. It's the sexual pleasure. People think it's orgasm, it's not. The higher the intensity of pleasure, the more we get those neurochemical reactions, whether
That's
or not orgasm happens.
Very interesting. Emily Nagoski with us, Kinsey educated, sex educator, author of Come Together, The Science and Art of Creating Lasting Sexual Connections. John Sovic, a frequent guest with us on Air Talk, queer therapist and coach. He specializes in working with clients who are LGBTQ+. We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Caleb in Pasadena emailed, I'm in a same-sex relationship, and I came to realize I'm on the asexual spectrum and have very little interest in sex. It required a conversation with my partner, but we've adapted, and both of us feel very connected and intimate without sex. Quality time together or other forms of touch, like hugs, cuddles, etc., is more satisfying for both of us than sex, and we feel close and very much in love. Caleb, thank you. John, I wonder if you had a relationship where, you know, one of the participants, sex was not, they were asexual, essentially, and the other, sex was very important. Do you think a relationship like that could work if the one for whom sex was important was given freedom to have sex outside of the relationship, or is that generally not workable?
So I think this is a conversation between the members in the relationship. And it is important, and Caleb said this so beautifully, there are other ways that's just than sexual intimacy.
And they're in agreement on this.
Yeah, and there's physical intimacy, there's emotional intimacy, there's having experiences together, there's sharing values together. And if you have a base of intimacy already in the relationship, then you could, with your partner or partners, have conversations about, do we need an open relationship as a means to satisfy whatever your sexual needs are, which are not the same as mine? And that is something that I think is unique in queer conversations, is that we, once again, because we don't have that rule book, have said, how can we work to make sure that everybody in the relationship is finding the pleasure they need? And if I could encourage my, you know, cisgender straight couples to look at this model, this deep communication, this understanding of intimacy, and pushing against these social constructs of monogamy being the only authentic way to be in a loving relationship, I think a lot of us could be a lot happier and have much more fulfilling sexual experiences that satisfy us and satisfy ourselves in our relationships.
Now, are you talking about polyamory? We talked about that a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying? Essentially, that there are couples that might benefit from it, but it's a taboo to explore that.
It is, yeah. And those social constructs of taboo are all over everything we do here in the United States. And I sometimes think, and I hear it in Emily's voice, if we can shake up those taboos, we can have more honest conversations with our partners and then find the pleasure we are seeking.
It's so scary. We'll continue. 866-893-5722. Or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Sex is so loaded with so many different stresses and pressures. But of course, the power of sex is profound. I'd love to hear from listeners, to what extent is sex a focal point or high priority in your intimate relationship or not? And has that evolved over the years? We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. We'll be back with more with Emily and John in just a minute. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by queer therapist and coach John Sovic. And Emily Nagoski is a Kinsey Institute educated sex educator and author of Come Together, the Science and Art of Creating Lasting Sexual Connections. I'd like to hear from you, to what extent sex plays a role in your intimate relationship. Has it changed over the years? Is sex perhaps the most important part? And why? What does it provide that makes that so important to the other aspects, the other bonding, the other ways you work well together as a couple? Or if sex has never been or has become a very low priority or not a part of your relationship, do you feel a loss at all in that or not? 866-893-5722. Karen in Silver Lake emailed, my partner and I are married 45 years. When our children were growing up and we were working, sex wasn't at all frequent. Now that we're retired and have time, we've rediscovered each other's bodies, and it's terrific. Toys are introduced. Wow. We now frequently enjoy an hour or more of sex time. Karen, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Dean in Pasadena emailed, sex is huge to me, but I can have the same great sex with a stranger or with my lover. Is that weird? As a heterosexual, is it me, or do men need sex more frequently than women? John?
I would suggest that that is another one of those beautiful mythologies that got put out into the world. I think the idea we need to understand is how we each, in our different genders, receive and experience pleasure and sex. And that's actually where the differences occur. And I love the fact that Karen was talking about sex and aging, and that they're taking their time with sex and exploring with sex. And that, to me, is another big piece of the puzzle. For so much sexual energy here in the U.S. especially, we look at the idea of achieving orgasm and penetration as what sex is about. And what Karen describes is ideas, no, we're exploring, we're playing, we're bringing in the things to bring pleasure into the conversation. And so the same thing can occur whether you're in a male-identified body or a female-identified body, that finding what pleasures you is actually where we can find where our sexual peaks and valleys are. And so this idea that men are driven more sexually than women, I think, is a mythology that we need to let go of and loosen up a little bit, because once again, we're looking at a patriarchal story here.
Emily Nagoski, your thoughts on this?
Oh, yes, there is enormous variability, and it's not defined by a person's gender how much interest they have in having sex. if there is a gender difference, it might be that people who identify as women experience their sexuality as more sensitive to context, which is to say the external circumstances and their internal state. But again, there is enormous variability. But on the subject of aging also, there's a wonderful book called Magnificent Sex, in which Peggy Klein Plotz and Dana Maynard talk about their research studying people who have extraordinary, optimal sexual experiences. And when I heard Peggy teach, she says that the typical age at which her research participants had their first experience of optimal sexual experiences was 55 years old.
Wow. So it takes time, definitely. I love that. Optimal sexual experiences. That's a great. Is that like a numerical scale that they determine that? Or how is
it? It's a qualitative description. They ask for people who experience themselves as having really exceptionally good sex. And they asked, so what does this sex look like? And it looks nothing like what the standard cultural narrative says. They don't talk about desire at all. They don't talk about how frequently they have sex. They talk about pleasure, of course. They talk about intimacy and authenticity and vulnerability. This is sex where everyone involved is glad to be there and gets to show up as their full, authentic self without shame or fear of being judged.
We're talking with Emily Nagoski, author of Come Together, The Science and Art of Creating Lasting Sexual Connections, and John Sovic, queer therapist and coach. Jess, in Marina Del Rey, I understand you're a relationship coach. Welcome to Air Talk.
Hi, thank you for having me on. And I can agree with everything that the panelists, and I have actually read her book, Come Together. It's a fantastic book. And I'm in a relationship with a woman who's substantially older than me. And sex is not necessarily about the orgasm and the patriarchy rule that we've all been told. It has to do with how much attention can you pay to the person. And if you build up the trust and the communication first, yes, it can go hours at a time. And that's what it should be, because it's all about building that intimacy together.
All right, Jess, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. 866-893-5722. John in Carson emailed, from a heterosexual married male perspective, I always had anxiety about an accidental pregnancy, even with birth control. After having the SNP recently, our sex life has flourished, I think, because that fear is gone. John, can you speak to the things like this, because this is one of many different fears or concerns that can intrude in people being able to really give themselves over to sex.
Mm-hmm. So there are so many barriers and stories that we were taught when we were growing up. This idea of having major anxiety about accidental pregnancy. This sounds like John is a responsible person and he's been taught this idea. But other things that come into play often too is, for males, the idea of size, the idea of performance, about being able to offer the right kind of pleasure. All of these fears and anxieties have been taught in how we are supposed to approach sex. In females, there's been this kind of submissive energy that's been mythologized in the world as how they become the most pleasurable thing to their partner. And all of these mythologies add up to create anxiety when we're just trying to bring two people together who want to have some fun, enjoy themselves, to celebrate their bodies. And if we can shed some of those things, and I think body image is a huge piece of the puzzle. It gets in the way for a lot of people having sexual intimacy.
Probably even more so for younger people on social media all the time.
Mm-hmm. And if we could release some of those barriers that we put into place and just see the spirit, the energy, the beauty of the person sitting across from that, and that be the beginning of intimacy, and then learn from each other and find pleasure, and then take that into sexual connection, that dropping all of those preconceived notions that cause the anxiety are the ways for us best to connect with the people that we want to connect in love, intimacy, and sex with.
Lindsay is line producing today. She's heard of people who were paralyzed with fear about sexually transmitted infections, that is such a fear for them. And you know, particularly, I think, for young people who grew up with the shadow of HIV and AIDS, that has been had a real chilling effect for many.
And the thing is, all of these things can have a chilling effect at the same time that can just become awareness. if we are taking care of our sexual health, if we're a sexually active person, if we're, you know, having regular checks up and screenings, we can manage our exposure to these STIs, and we can have a very wonderful, positive, sexually active life simply by being responsible for ourselves and being responsible for the partners we connect with.
Kim in Malibu emailed, "I'm thrilled Emily Nagoski's one of your guests. I'm currently reading her book, Come As You Are. Her discussion about how anxiety and its triggering of our fight or flight response can put the brakes on sexual interest really landed with me and my experiences. This book is so insightful. Both my partner and I had a lack of family love and support, and we found for us sex plays a huge role in filling up those needs that we didn't get filled as children. It's a big part of our connection and bonding. I think we both value the closeness and intimacy in ways I haven't experienced with other partners. He also cares about my pleasure, and like your earlier comment, that's changed my level of interest in sex. In this relationship, we both care about each other's enjoyment." That's Kim in Malibu. 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. We're taking your calls about the role of sex in loving relationships all this week. Air Talk devoting itself to love. It's Valentine's week. Austin Cross will be in tomorrow and Friday also talking about aspects of love. Today, it's sex. We'll be back in a minute. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. John Sovic with us, queer therapist and coach, and Emily Nagoski, who is author of Come Together, The Science and Art of Creating Lasting Sexual Connections. She's a sex educator. Let me read more listener comments that are coming in. Our topic of sex and love. David in Van Nuys, "I've been in a relationship with my husband for 27 years. As we got older, sex fell by the wayside. My partner has a tendency of taking this personally. Sex identifies him. For me, it's a new chapter in life. It doesn't make a difference to me." David, thank you for that. John, what do you do when there is differential interest in sex like that? And they've been together almost 3 decades.
Well, it's interesting because I'm not sure if I hear a differential in sex in this conversation with David. I hear that maybe they have taken the priority of it off their list. And so it's interesting to me because I think it's really amazing having sex in a long-term relationship, because what you do is you have someone you know really well. You have the ability to communicate better, and you have a level of intimacy and trust that maybe someone who's just starting to date doesn't have. So why not build on those factors and figure out what kind of sexual life would you like to have for yourselves? And we've talked about Karen, and she's like, she was quite a bit older, and she was talking about it's exciting. She's exploring. She's learning.
It's exciting to read of her excitement.
Yeah. And so that's the thing, is to look at it. It's like, David, what do you want to create with your partner? Are there things maybe that you haven't communicated to each other over the years that would help you re-explore and reignite your sexual connection, knowing that you have those 27 years of history to trust each other in the bedroom?
Let's take another listener comment. Nancy in Long Beach emailed, "I'm a lesbian, but I was also married to a man before I came out. In both long-term relationships with my ex-husband and ex-wife, the amount of sex we had depended a lot on how I was feeling about my partner at that time and if we were having problems in the relationship. In both, when I felt unhappy, the amount of sex we had decreased." Nancy, I really appreciate that. And I think that makes sense. That's how, you know, for many of us, sex is linked to our feelings, whether we're angry or feeling disconnected with our partner. But Emily, I wonder, because sex can also be, pardon the expression, a lubricant in a relationship. It can help bring people together also. So is there ever a case to be made for prescriptive sex?
Oh, prescriptive sex, no, but individualized exploration, yes, always. One of the questions I ask people to explore in my workshops is, what is it that you want when you want sex? Because it's not just physical release. Most people can do that on their own, and if they can't, there are whole workshops and books just about that. But what is it that you want when you want someone else to be there involved? And the number one thing people say is connection, is because sex itself, nothing bad happens to you physically if you don't have sex, but our health is impacted. We can sicken and die of loneliness. And for some people, sex is a primary way of experiencing connection in a relationship. People also talk about shared pleasure, the experience of being or feeling wanted, and of course, the freedom to stop paying attention to all the stressors and roles and identities that we have to fulfill in our actual lives. Close the door on all that and just focus on the pleasurable things happening in the here and now. It goes far beyond just wanting the physical experience and much deeper into our identities and our shared connection.
We have Jeannie and Cerritos who emailed, what about the impact of sexual violence experienced by so many? This continues to inhibit pleasure even in a long-term marriage. Any hint of pressure or force or demand sparks withdrawal. It's improved a lot over the years with an extremely sensitive partner, but never 100% disappeared. That's Jeannie in Cerritos. Emily?
Yes, it is. One day I'll write a book about sex that doesn't have to talk about trauma, but that is not this book. What happens in the brain when we experience sexual trauma is the mechanism that controls sexual response is the dual control mechanism that has an accelerator that responds to any sex-related stimuli. But then there's also a brake that responds to things that are perceived as threats. And when sex is used against us as a weapon, your brain learns that this sex-related stimulus that activates the accelerator also is a threat, so it also hits the brakes. So the process of healing from trauma is the experience of decoupling the sense that something sex-related is happening from the experience that it is a potential threat. And it's like unlearning a lot of phobias, and people heal from trauma all the time. It is a gradual process, but it takes care and support in order for that healing to happen. And it does happen every day.
Franya in Pasadena, we're very short on time, but please share with us your experience.
Thank you. I learned about 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, from a man who was advising some couples. My partner and I were together for 48 years. And I would say the last 5 years or so, I used the technique that I learned from this guru, I guess you could call him. At any rate, he said, sometimes it takes about 5 days to lead up to a very satisfying sexual relationship, sexual experience for both partners. For the last 5 years or so, before my partner passed away, I used that technique of leading up to intimacy. I just did it for 5 days with touching, extra loving. It was very successful. That's not to say we didn't have sex times. For instance, he had a habit of waking up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and being very intimate. Really worked.
Franya, we're so tight on time, but I really appreciate your call. So, John, what do you think of an approach like that, allowing the build over, say, 5 days?
So I also happen to have a life as a yoga teacher, and we are looking at all kinds of different approaches to sex that are outside of the ways we've been taught that sex is supposed to exist. And it can be beautiful to make the sexual experience a longer experience, a thing of heightening sensation, a piece of using pleasure in ways that aren't leading to orgasm all the time. And so, yeah, it can be an incredibly valuable thing. But I also say it this way. There are as many different kinds of sex as many times as you want to have sex. Sometimes it might just be for fun. Sometimes it might be a playful thing. Sometimes it might be a way to look into your partner and create intimacy. Sometimes it might be a planned out experience like this. You're actually going on a journey together. And sometimes it's just for getting off. And I think it's got to be okay that we understand it's not just one thing, and we and our partners get to design what it is for us.
John, thank you so much as always. Always fun to have you on the program and sharing your expertise on this. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
John Sovic, Pasadena-based therapist, specializes in working with LGBTQ plus clients in his practice. And Emily Nagoski, who's a sex educator and author of Come Together, The Science and Art of Creating Lasting Sexual Connections. Emily, thank you so much for coming on. You've got an open invitation. Look forward to having you come back.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Just a reminder, Austin Cross is in for me tomorrow and Friday. I'll be back with you following President's Day on Tuesday, and I'll be with you, of course, for Film Week on Friday. And just want to let you know, Monday for President's Day, when we're off for the holiday, the 2 hours of Air Talk are totally devoted to big names, actors and directors of Oscar-nominated films. The interviews I've done thus far, you'll hear it Monday at 9 o'clock. Have a great day.